prophecies of the world tomorrow.
You are living in the end of an age. You're privileged to live at the close of one age and the transition period of the dawning of a new and a different age. Most of us are completely unaware of that transcendent fact of our modern day. A recent controversial computer study has revealed that world trends all taken into account today. We are living in the crisis at the close of an age, that we are about to be plunged back into something that would make the Middle Ages look tame by comparison. And there are many facts that prove this, not the least of which, a statement made by a leading agronomist or agriculturalist, a person who has made salvation of humankind and certainly the malnutrition, food versus population picture of big nations all around the world, and certainly the United States and the affluent countries of Western Europe, his concern. His name is Dr. George Borgstrom, professor of food science, nutrition, and geography at Michigan State University. I'd like to go through this briefly because this epitomizes what I've said so often on this program, on radio as well as television now, that we are living in a time when the problems of this world have simply gotten too big for us to solve. Now, here are the facts. If you can think seriously and face reality for just a few moments and listen to this, appraise it, think about it, ponder it a minute, because it has to do with your life. It has to do with your future. Man is hurtling toward a hunger crisis, he says, that science alone cannot stop. He sees salvation only in international cooperation, but let's define what kind of cooperation he means in a moment. He says we're living in a dream world. The average person stands in awe of technology. People forget about reality. They don't listen to what they don't want to hear. We always seem to believe that science will come along at the last moment of the ninth inning and save us from ourselves. People are vaguely aware there's such a thing as a population explosion. That every single year, the nation of China adds the equivalent of another Canada. That every single year, the nation of India adds the equivalent of another Australia. That every 39 days, the world adds the equivalent of another New York City. What does this mean to us? What does it mean to the Western world, especially the United States of America, where about 6% of the population of the earth are consuming busily about 50%, some of them said 52% now, of all of the raw materials? And in the last 30 years, the United States of America has consumed about 50% of all of the natural and raw reserves and materials that were available to all of humankind in the years that went before. We are rapidly running out of those reserves. These are facts, not vague, ethereal, spiritual, doctrinal beliefs of some church, but facts of our daily, everyday world. Now, this man said, in reality, that Earth's resources are dwindling rapidly, and no amount of scientific trickery can meet the food demands of an ever-spiraling population. He said unless nations get together and plan the use of remaining resources, he foresees a future of famine. He said it would take 30 to 40 million acres of new farmland every year just to keep the world at its present malnourished level. To improve nutrition. And remember, let me give you a few things here just to throw in before going on with these statements, shocking statements made by a man who is eminent and respected in his field, and whom I have quoted oftentimes, who is quoted in the book that we have on agriculture, the one on famine that we have, that you can have by return mail free of charge, even if you don't see him advertised on this one particular program. But remember those booklets on agriculture as well as famine, full color, free of charge, no price. He's talking about improving nutrition. Remember that in the Philippines, for example, every single Filipino baby that is born, of every one of them, half of them die before they reach the age of one. Remember, too, that life expectancy is still about 39 years of age in India. Remember that some of the real have-not countries, Indonesia, some of Southeast Asia, of China, India, Central and South America, some of the nations of Africa. Here is where people have a fantastic mortality rate. Infant mortality is very high. And the ironic, the bizarre reality of this is that for all of this starvation, malnutrition that takes millions of lives every year, the bloated bodies, I remember, who was it telling me just the other day? He was in Korea. He was in the MPs. A little boy, I guess it was, walked up and was begging food. And just as was commonplace, there were so many teeming children around. And always begging, always everywhere. The streets loaded with little orphans and waifs, just begging from the Americans all the time. And he just said, go away, as they did so commonly. And the boy went over there and sat down and put his head on his shoulder and toppled over and died. And he's never gotten that out of his mind. He thought, he didn't know any better, young boy then, maybe in his early 20s, maybe even pre-20 age, he thought the little kid had been so successful begging that his little stomach was distended. He was so full with what he'd had to eat. When in reality, it was the signs of starvation. His body absolutely bloated, skinny, emaciated arms and legs, but that bloated stomach. There are millions of such children that live in nations like that all over the world that die every single week, every month. And the ironic twist of it all is that they're not dying fast enough. That in those very nations where infant mortality, where starvation and malnutrition take such a fearsome toll, that they are not dying fast enough because these are the nations experiencing the most rapid increase in population. When I say that world problems even defy description, let alone solutions, as we know what those solutions can be today, and when you think about the possibility of nations cooperating together to solve these crises in time, let your mind really think about it for a little while, and just imagine, if you can, with all of our racial difficulties, all of our ethnic difficulties, the group and the tribal instincts, the political problems, the military problems, the growing climate of trade war around the world today, international uncooperation. What do you think our chances are as a community of humankind, a global community on which we all live, to get together to solve these problems? Look at the deep-seated hatred between Israel and the Arab countries. Yet look at Israel, a tiny country with a higher concentration of mind power, with more doctors, more dentists, more musicians, more lawyers, more highly skilled, university-trained people per capita than probably any other nation on the face of the earth. Here is a nation that has had the skill to turn the desert into a flowering, beautiful place. A nation that has learned how to farm the Negev, the desert. A nation where the technology exists that if the Arab countries could just get rid of all of this, and the Jewish people too, all of them, get rid of the antagonisms, get rid of the ethnic and the racial, the religious differences, here are all these poverty-stricken neighbors who so desperately need what those Jewish people could provide. It's something I've thought of quite often. So here is this very eminent and respected man, Dr. George Borgstrom, who says to improve nutrition on this earth, we will need a doubling of food production by 1980. Now, when we're increasing at such a tiny rate, and the whole problem of monoculture, the problem of lean years in vast nations that completely take the entirety of American and Canadian and other big nations' food grain reserves on some occasions, or eat into them so dramatically that that in itself could be a crisis. Well, what do you think our chances are about doubling food production by 1980 would be interesting to hear sometime. I don't think the chances are very good. I think they are too, slim and none. And that's not meant to be facetious. That's just the way it is. When this man says, and he is a studious man who knows what he's talking about, he is not just one wildfire man sitting in a cave over there with a can of tomato juice waiting for the second coming or something like this. He is a man who is studying science, who is studying the curves of agriculture versus population, who has at his fingertips information from all over the world. A noted man who has been quoted in books and journals by other scientists on this problem time and time again. And when he says it will take 30 to 40 million acres of new farmland every year just to keep us even, then I would tell you that is a problem of apocalyptic proportions. An enormous problem.
Today's farmers are agricultural professionals, managers, and salesmen. As they develop new skills in food production, will they be able to meet the growing demands of supplying food to a hungry world? For an authoritative look at this important question, be sure to request the free booklet, World Crisis in Agriculture. Of further interest, the Ambassador College publication, Famine, Can We Survive?, takes a hard look at growing populations and world food resources. Today, every other person on Earth faces possible starvation. Could famine ever affect you? Get the facts. Read Famine, Can We Survive? World Crisis in Agriculture and Famine, Can We Survive? Companion booklets, available free of charge. These booklets will help you understand the true scope of these worldwide problems. Request your copies today and be informed. Send your request to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 44, Vancouver, B.C. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 44, Vancouver, B.C.
What do you think our chances are of really solving these problems? Are you willing to face it, or do you think it's going to happen 100 years from now, so therefore it won't happen during your lifetime? Well, that's small comfort for your grandchildren, but I'm here to tell you these great approaching crises are going to explode in your lifetime. They will not wait for another 40 or 60 or 100 years. They are imminent. They are at the door. They are here and now. What do you think the chances are that this world will double food production in another 8 years? What do you think the chances are that it will quadruple by 2000? And even if it does, since we are going to double world population by 2000, and then double that doubled population in another 14 years, what do you think our chances are of survival, period? It's something to ponder, isn't it? They say world government. They say a rule of law. They say global cooperation. They say nations must get together. And nations can't even get together when it comes to selecting judges and referees for Olympic athletic events. Nations can't even get together when it has to do with a simple problem between the United States and Japan, of a nation with a cheap labor force willing to work itself to death, virtually, to put itself back into the community of big industrial powers. And so the imbalance between Japanese exports that are coming into the United States and American exports going into Japan is so vast that the Americans find themselves being undercut, outstripped, outsold. They cannot compete with the Japanese markets, with the Japanese industry. And so therefore, here is this giant diplomatic problem which becomes not just an economic problem, but eventually diplomatic, and finally maybe even a military problem. Nations are not going to cooperate on these things. No, instead, the divisiveness between nations has grown greater since World War II, and it is deepening today along the same lines as it did prior to World War II, beginning as a trade war, and with a specter ever present on the horizon of an economic collapse in the United States of America. Shocking words, but I believe prophetic words, and I think it's time someone began to listen before it's too late. Now, Dr. George Borgstrom said that every one of these panaceas tends to have its own problem. People say, well, we'll go farm the Amazon. There are all these rainforests and jungles. Well, you ought to write for our booklet on famine and find out whether or not that is a really workable solution. People don't seem to understand that a rainforest is a rainforest because of the rain. The enormous amount of rain in the Amazon basin that takes all that topsoil over these thousands of years and washes it right out to sea. And why is the Amazon so big and so wide and so muddy? Because all that topsoil has been washed right off that land. And why is the rainforest there? With those giant impenetrable thickets and trunks. You know, the very task, you might think it's easy. Science can come along, you can kind of imagine all these bulldozers going in there and clearing the forest. You ought to do like we've done. Send researchers into the depths of the Amazon jungles, which we have done, right to the soil experimental stations they have, tiny little plots in the middle of the jungle, which we have done, and find out for yourself with your own eyes, which we have done, whether or not this is possible. You ought to read books like the one Famine 1975, America's Decision, Who Will Survive by William and Paul Paddock, which in one chapter investigates whether or not this so-called panacea, this dream world Alice in Wonderland solution for the problem of food production, of farming the rainforest, can really work. Here's another thing to think about. People say, well, all you got to do is get out there and irrigate those deserts. And here's the continuing fight between a burgeoning, exploding population in California and that of Arizona over water rights of one river. And all you got to do is to have a bad winter, a light snowpack, and not the same amount of water that comes roaring down the Colorado River every single year. And here are these big cities that are dependent upon. Millions of people are using something like 135 gallons per man, woman, and child per day. And yet it all comes from basically one river. But we think all you got to do is turn on the tap. We don't know where these energy sources are, where these life support systems come from. You ask a kid, the average kid, 5 years of age, where does your milk come from? Your homogenized boiled milk that has been all stirred together and won't even separate anymore, which is sad. Where does it come from? Out of the carton. Well, where'd you get the carton, son?
Well, we went to the supermarket and got it at the counter there.
Well, how did it get put in the carton?
Well, if he's 5, his knowledge might stop there. But if he's 8 or 10, he might say, well, from the dairy. But that's about as far as the average kid, even on up in high school, is going to go with it.
When you begin to ask him what he thinks in terms of sunshine, the basic energy source, which produced the grass, the irrigation it took to grow the grass, or the rainfall that came down, and the cow, and the whole process of farming or the dairy industry, all of the food that had to be grown to produce all of this, and then the machinery and the equipment, the electric equipment maybe to milk the cow, the truck that brought it to the city, the way it was packaged, the way it was sold. Well, all we do is go to the store and we buy, and it's there because we're an affluent society. We know it's waiting for us. But how does all this keep going? Is there ever a time when it can break down? The average citizen, when he goes to bed in Los Angeles, is not aware of the vast armada of growling, rumbling trucks, the whistle of faraway trains that are thundering into this city every single night, the avalanche of goods. He wouldn't go down to the markets at 2 and 3 and 4 in the morning where the truck drivers are, where some of the auctions and the sales are going on, where independent buyers are down there, or where the big chains have their trucks coming in from other states, or up in the valley, or out in the Coachella, or the other valleys around, where all of these goods are coming. They're not aware of the fact that the Central Valley of California grows about 46% of the total vegetable supply for the entirety of the United States of America. One tiny little fertile valley with a prodigious outpouring of chemical fertilizers and sprays and preservatives and so on. It's a magical process. It's all packaged. It's plastic wrapped. It's sealed in a can. You pop the top and there it is to eat or to drink. But where does it come from? Turn on the tap and there it is. Go to the supermarket and there it is. It isn't quite that simple. It comes out of the ground. Man is only going to survive as long as he can keep on farming the ground. Does that sound like some great, inspiring new revelation? It shouldn't, but you know, too often people don't even think about these life support systems. We don't think about the ultimate source of where we get the things we eat. So people sit around in an armchair, Alice in Wonderland, kind of a daydream. They say, oh, they can go farm the deserts. Listen to what Dr. George Borgstrom says about that. If that is a sweeping panacea, then he wonders, what will you do with the salts left from evaporation when you begin to farm the desert? Well, how will you protect the groundwater in these areas from contamination? What will you do to keep particles from filling the pores of the soil, creating hard pan, just as hard as a rock, you can bend a shovel on it, and useless marshland? Another popular idea he talked about is the fish farms in the sea. We've heard talk of artificial, ersatz, you know, as they said, kind of foods, and it's been tried in some areas of the world. Is that going to work? Is that a panacea that will cure all ills? I'll tell you what he says about that. But you ought to write for those booklets I've talked about famine, and whether or not we have an opportunity to survive in our day. And in a moment, too, I'll tell you of a prophecy in your Bible that said it would get this way, that unless some kind of an intervention would come along beyond the knowledge of man, the present experience of man, the present technology of man, there wouldn't be a man, woman, or child left alive.
While people struggled through the Depression, The Plain Truth magazine was warning about European nationalism. When everyone sighed relief at the end of World War II, The Plain Truth was predicting the Middle East crisis. When Korea dominated the headlines, The Plain Truth was forecasting the formation of the common market. When the space race captured America's fancy, The Plain Truth was covering trade war and the rise of Japan, future supergiant. The Plain Truth magazine examines everything from world events to family life in the light of Bible prophecy, history written in advance. To keep ahead of today's world trends, request your free subscription to The Plain Truth magazine. After 40 years, still ahead of its time. Send your request to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 44, Vancouver, B.C. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 44, Vancouver, B.C.
There are prophecies in your Bible that foretold we would be living in the time of the end. Now, I was
said to have reported to a reporter that I am preaching about the end of the world. I am not doing any such a thing. Jesus Christ of Nazareth did not talk about the end of the world, meaning the end of the earth, the end of the globe, or the orb, the sphere on which we live. No, he talked about the transitional age. He talked about the end of a global system of man's governments. And he talked about the dawning of a new age, and I don't mean the age of Aquarius, of God's government. But he showed that that is not going to come except at the last moment, where it is the only alternative to the salvation of humankind. And I do not speak now of the kind of salvation you have heard about most of your life, where you're supposed to kind of say hocus pocus, or now I lay me down to sleep, or what is it? Oh, yes, I believe. And then suddenly, you're going to go to that different place. You're going to go up there. No, I'm talking of something which is very dear to my heart, of being saved alive, not saved dead. And here in your Bible, if you're willing to look it up, in Matthew, the 24th chapter, after describing the calamitous events, including famines and pestilences in different places, Jesus said there is hope. He said the signs that we would be living in the time of the end would be, first of all, a massive religious revival, and the message would be that he, Jesus, is the Christ, and many would be deceived. Then he said, you shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. That's verse 6 of Matthew 24. See that you be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, and the end is not yet. Nation, he said, shall rise against nation. And we're right now seeing the realignment of national powers. New alliances forming. Along the lines now of economic trading combines, but later you will live to see them become hostile, divided against each other, and certainly lined up and divided against the United States and the Western democracies mostly. And he said, there shall be famines. Well, you know, the doctors of science are saying there shall be famines. William and Paul Paddock talk about famine. So many of these men that I have quoted time and again, in our booklet on famine, you will see one after another, serious students of agriculture, of population, of demographics and the like, will tell you that we're entering a period where we're going to see massive starvation. They don't have any spiritual or religious axe to grind. So far as I know, these men like Dr. Barry Commoner, who has been called the modern Jeremiah of science, are not out trying to get a following. They're not out in the street corner handing out tracts and saying, flee from the wrath to come. They are serious scientists. They don't belong to a political party. They're not speaking to promote a platform of some kind or another. They're trying to warn mankind of what their studies are showing. And I'm trying to show you that their studies and the very tools of science admit that what Jesus Christ of Nazareth said is the truth. That we're living in the time of the close of an age, the end of man's way of life on this earth, apart from the government of God. Now, Christ said there will be famines and pestilences, and that means disease epidemics and earthquakes in different places. And he said in verse 14, this good news of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world as a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end, not the end of humankind, as I'll show you, not the end of man's experience on the earth, the end of an age, then shall the end come. So he said in verse 21, for then shall be great trouble, a great troublous times, great tribulation such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no nor ever shall be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. So he talked about a divine intervention. He talked about not the end of the globe, not the end of all of humankind, but the end of an age and the dawning of a new and a different age. Now, almost as if with one voice, world leaders continually say world government is the only solution. Dr. George Borgstrom said, unless nations get together, they can't possibly solve this problem. Caltech's Harrison Brown, here in Pasadena, California, has been warning for a long time. Mankind has arrogance, a kind of an arrogant assumption, that man's technological management of the planet exempts him from the limitations nature imposes on every other species. Almost certainly, he said, the world is slated to experience dramatic, even explosive changes within the next 2 or 3 decades. He's not setting any dates. He's talking in terms of 10, 20, 30 years, but he says explosive changes. Now, he told the U.S. Congress in a subcommittee Modern technology has linked the peoples of the world in a vast communications network. The poor now are able to see how the rich live, and would like to share some of that affluence. Desires for more rapid development are intensified, and whereas a few years ago, the poor might have been more or less content with their lot because they couldn't see the differences, the disparity, today they are impatient and are increasingly willing to use strong, even violent means to help attain their goals. Food wars, I have said time and again, global food wars that are going to cause such massive riotous upheavals they can bring about the dramatic overthrow of government in nations such as China, such as India, nations like Indonesia and elsewhere, in Central and South America and in Africa, the realignment of various power blocks, these are going to affect you. The food on your table, your job, where you live. You cannot sit there in a ready-made daydream in your own living room or family room and say, let the rest of the world go by, because it will come crushing in on you. Now, there is a solution to all of this. It's not a solution you have to believe in to make it happen. It's not something I'm asking you to accept, and then if enough of us get together, we can bring about. But Jesus Christ of Nazareth talked of a world government. He talked of vast agrarian reform. The Bible talks about what is really needed, a world governing authority, the only way to survival for humankind. Isn't it a shame that that message is largely ignored, that you hardly ever hear that? Oh, you hear stories about what a nice man Jesus was. People call him a vagabond, the first hippie, almost anything except what he really was. Write for this booklet on just what do you mean, the kingdom of God. Is it within you? Is it a church? Is it a nation? Is it an ethereal spiritual idea? Was it an idea of Christ's? Or is it a literal world-ruling government? And the booklet on the modern Romans and shows you where our societies are today. They're free of charge, no price. Here is a booklet that will put you in the scene of the way things are developing to fulfill Bible prophecy right now. Rome fell. That's a fact of history. But why? An empire that people said would always exist. And we go over there to major cities in Italy, and especially in Rome itself, and still can walk in and upon and admire some of the architecture, some of the giant buildings and edifices, the columns, the arches, and the splendiferous achievements of the builders of that time. Well, back then, the Roman citizen basked in affluence, in the glitter of his empire, the explosive frenzy of building of huge cities bejeweled with rising marble columns, of paved, pleasant, tree-lined avenues and rushing fountains and waters. And he, too, thought, this can never come down. This booklet, The Modern Romans, will put you in the picture in modern-day United States of America, Canada, Britain, Australia, South Africa, and other countries, and show you how our Western English-speaking world is going the way of ancient Rome. And it costs you nothing, only the price of a stamp and an envelope, to send your letter to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 44. That's Post Office Box 44, Vancouver, B.C. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.